He felt a flutter of panic, yet he had made his decision when he chose to speak to Griphook first. Feigning a calm he did not feel, he groped in the pouch around his neck and took out the two halves of his broken wand. "Mr. Ollivander, I need some help."
"Anything, anything," said the wand maker weakly.
"Can you mend this? Is it possible?" Ollivander held out a trembling hand, and Harry placed the two barely connected halves into his palm.
"Holly and Phoenix Feather," said Ollivander in a tremulous voice. 11 inches. Nice and supple."
"Yes," said Harry. "Can you—"
"No,"
whispered Ollivander.
"I am sorry, very sorry. But a wand that has suffered this degree of damage cannot be repaired by any means that I know of."
Harry had been braced to hear it, but it was a blow nevertheless. He took the wand halves back and replaced them in the pouch around his neck. Ollivander stared at the place where the shattered wand had vanished, and did not look away until Harry had taken from his pocket the two wands he had brought from the Malfoys.
"Can you identify these?" Harry asked.
The wandmaker took the first of the wands and held it close to his faded eyes, rolling it between his knobble-knuckled fingers, flexing it slightly.
"Walnut and dragon heartstring," he said. 12¾ inches. Unyielding. This wand belonged to Bellatrix Lestrange."
"And this one?" Ollivander performed the same examination.
"Hawthorn and unicorn hair. 10 inches precisely. Reasonably springy. This was the wand of Draco Malfoy."
"Was?" repeated Harry. "Isn't it still his?"
"Perhaps not, if you took it."
"I did."
"Then it may be yours. Of course, the manner of taking matters. Much also depends upon the wand itself. In general, however, where a wand has been won, its allegiance will change."
There was silence in the room, except for the distant rushing of the sea. "You talk about wands like they've got feelings," said Harry. "Like they can think for themselves."
"The wand chooses the wizard," said Ollivander. "That much has always been clear to those of us who have studied wand lore."
"A person can still use a wand that hasn't chosen them, though?" asked Harry.
"Oh, yes. If you are any wizard at all, you will be able to channel your magic through almost any instrument. The best results, however, must always come where there is the strongest affinity between wizard and wand. These connections are complex. An initial attraction, and then a mutual quest for experience. The wand learning from the wizard from the wand."
The sea gushed forward and backward. It was a mournful sound. "I took this wand from Draco Malfoy by force," said Harry. "Can I use it safely?"
"I think so. Subtle laws govern wand ownership, but the conquered wand will usually bend its will to its new master."
"So I should use this one," said Ron, pulling Wormtail's wand out of his pocket and handing it to Ollivander.
"Chestnut and dragon heartstring. 9¼ inches. Brittle. I was forced to make this shortly after my kidnapping for Peter Pettigrew. Yes, if you won it, it is more likely to do your bidding and do it well than another wand."
"And this holds true for all wands, does it?" asked Harry.
"I think so,"
replied Ollivander, his protuberant eyes upon Harry's face.
"You ask deep questions, Mr. Potter. Wand lore is a complex and mysterious branch of magic."
"So, it isn't necessary to kill the previous owner to take true possession of a wand?" asked Harry. Ollivander swallowed.
"Necessary? No, I should not say that it is necessary to kill."
"There are legends, though," said Harry, and as his heart rate quickened, the pain in his scar became more intense. He was sure that Voldemort had decided to put his idea into action. Legends about a wand, or wands, that have passed from hand to hand by murder. Ollivander turned pale. Against the snowy pillow he was light grey, and his eyes were enormous, bloodshot, and bulging with what looked like fear.
"Only one wand, I think," he whispered.
"And you know who is interested in it, isn't he?" asked Harry.
"How?"
croaked Ollivander, and he looked appealingly at Ron and Hermione for help.
"How do you know this?"
"He wanted you to tell him how to overcome the connection between our wands," said Harry. Ollivander looked terrified.
"He tortured me. You must understand that. The Cruciatus curse. I had no choice but to tell him what I knew, what I guessed."
"I understand," said Harry. "You told him about the twin cores? You said he just had to borrow another wizard's wand?" Ollivander looked horrified, transfixed by the amount that Harry knew. He nodded slowly. "But it didn't work," Harry went on. "Mine still beat the borrowed wand. Do you know why that is?" Ollivander shook his head as slowly as he had just nodded.
"I had never heard of such a thing. Your wand performed something unique that night. The connection of the twin cores is incredibly rare. Yet why your wand should have snapped the borrowed wand, I do not know."
"We were talking about the other wand, the wand that changes hands by murder. When you-know-who realized my wand had done something strange, he came back and asked about that other wand, didn't he?"
"How do you know this?"
Harry did not answer.
"Yes, he asked,"
whispered Ollivander.
"He wanted to know everything I could tell him about the wand, variously known as the Death Stick, the Wand of Destiny, or the Elder Wand."
Harry glanced sideways at Hermione. She looked flabbergasted.
"The Dark Lord,"
said Ollivander in hushed and frightened tones,
"had always been happy with the wand I made him, you and Phoenix Feather, 13.5 inches, until he discovered the connection of the twin cores. Now he seeks another, more powerful wand, as the only way to conquer yours."
"But he'll know soon, if he doesn't already, that mine's broken beyond repair," said Harry quietly.
"No,"
said Hermione, sounding frightened.
"He can't know that, Harry. How could he?"
"Priori incantatum," said Harry. "We left your wand and the Blackthorn wand at the Malfoys, Hermione. If they examine them properly, make them recreate the spells they've cast lately, they'll see that yours broke mine. They'll see that you tried and failed to mend it, and they'll realize that I've been using the Blackthorn one ever since." The little color she had regained since their arrival had drained from her face. Ron gave Harry a reproachful look and said,
"Let's not worry about that now."
But Mr. Ollivander intervened.
"The Dark Lord no longer seeks the Elder Wand only for your destruction, Mr. Potter. He is determined to possess it because he believes it will make him truly invulnerable."
"And will it?"
"The owner of the Elder Wand must always fear attack," said Ollivander. "But the idea of the Dark Lord in possession of the Death Stick is, I must admit, formidable."
Harry was suddenly reminded of how he had been unsure when they first met, of how much he liked Ollivander. Even now, having been tortured and imprisoned by Voldemort, the idea of the dark wizard in possession of this wand seemed to enthrall him as much as it repulsed him.
You really think this wand exists, then, Mr. Ollivander?"
asked Hermione.
"Oh, yes," said Ollivander. "Yes, it is perfectly possible to trace the wand's course through history. There are gaps, of course, and long ones, where it vanishes from view, temporarily lost or hidden, but always it resurfaces. It has certain identifying characteristics that those who are learned in wand lore recognize. There are written accounts, some of them obscure, that I and other wand makers have made it our business to study. They have the ring of authenticity. So you don't think it can be a fairy tale or a myth?"
Hermione asked hopefully.
"No,"
said Ollivander.
"Whether it needs to pass by murder, I do not know. Its history is bloody, but that may be simply due to the fact that it is such a desirable object and arouses such passions in wizards. immensely powerful, dangerous in the wrong hands, and an object of incredible fascination to all of us who study the power of wands.
Mr. Ollivander, said Harry, you told you-know-who that Grigorovitch had the Elder Wand, didn't you? Ollivander turned, if possible, even paler. He looked ghostly as he gulped.
But how? How do you...
Never mind how I know it, said Harry, closing his eyes momentarily as his scar burned and he saw, for mere seconds, a vision of the main street in Hogsmeade, still dark, because it was so much farther north. You told you-know-who that Grigorovitch had the wand?
It was a rumor,
whispered Ollivander.
A rumor years and years ago, long before you were born. I believe Grigorovitch himself started it. You can see how good it would be for business that he was studying and duplicating the qualities of the Elder Wand.
Yes, I can see that, said Harry. He stood up. Mr. Ollivander, one last thing, and then we'll let you get some rest. What do you know about the Deathly Hallows?
The what?
Asked the wand maker, looking utterly bewildered. The Deathly Hallows.
I'm afraid I don't know what you're talking about. Is this still something to do with wands?
Harry looked into the sunken face and believed that Ollivander was not acting. He did not know about the Hallows. Thank you, said Harry. Thank you very much. We'll leave you to get some rest now. Ollivander looked stricken.
He was torturing me, he gasped. The Cruciatus curse. You have no idea.
I do, said Harry. I really do. Please, get some rest. Thank you for telling me all of this. He led Ron and Hermione down the staircase. Harry caught a glimpse of Bill, Fleur, Luna and Dean sitting at the table in the kitchen, cups of tea in front of them. They all looked up at Harry as he appeared in the doorway, but he merely nodded to them and continued into the garden, Ron and Hermione behind him. The reddish mound of earth that covered Dobby lay ahead, and Harry walked back to it, as the pain in his head built more and more powerfully. It was a huge effort now to close down the visions that were forcing themselves upon him. But he knew that he would have to resist only a little longer. He would yield very soon, because he needed to know that his theory was right. He must make only one more short effort so that he could explain to Ron and Hermione. Grigorovitch had the Elder Wand a long time ago, he said. I saw you-know-who trying to find him. When he tracked him down, he found that Grigorovitch didn't have it anymore. It was stolen from him by Grindelwald. How Grindelwald found out that Grigorovitch had it, I don't know. But if Grigorovitch was stupid enough to spread the rumor, it can't have been that difficult. Voldemort was at the gates of Hogwarts. Harry could see him standing there and see, too, the lamp bobbing in the pre-dawn, coming closer and closer. And Grindelwald used the Elder Wand to become powerful, and at the height of his power, when Dumbledore knew he was the only one who could stop him, he duelled Grindelwald and beat him, and he took the Elder Wand.
Dumbledore had the Elder Wand, said Ron. But then, where is it now?
At Hogwarts, said Harry, fighting to remain with them in the clifftop garden.
But then, let's go, said Ron urgently. Harry, let's go and get it before he does.
It's too late for that, said Harry. He could not help himself, but clutched his head, trying to help it resist.
He knows where it is. He's there now.
Harry! Ron said furiously.
How long have you known this? Why have we been wasting time? Why did you talk to Griphook first? We could have gone. We could still go.
No, said Harry, and he sank to his knees in the grass.
Hermione is right. Dumbledore didn't want me to have it. He didn't want me to take it. He wanted me to get the Horcruxes.
The unbeatable wand, Harry,
moaned Ron.
I'm not supposed to. I'm supposed to get the Horcruxes.
And now everything was cool and dark. The sun was barely visible over the horizon as he glided alongside Snape, up through the grounds toward the lake.
I shall join you in the castle shortly,
he said in his high, cold voice.
Leave me now.
Snape bowed and set off back up the path, his black cloak billowing behind him. Harry walked slowly, waiting for Snape's figure to disappear. It would not do for Snape, or indeed anyone else, to see where he was going, But there were no lights in the castle windows, and he could conceal himself. And in a second he had cast upon himself a disillusionment charm that hid him even from his own eyes. And he walked on, around the edge of the lake, taking in the outlines of the beloved castle, his first kingdom, his birthright. And here it was, beside the lake, reflected in the dark waters. The white marble tomb, an unnecessary blot on the familiar landscape. He felt again that rush of controlled euphoria, that heady sense of purpose in destruction. He raised the old yew wand. How fitting that this would be its last great act. The tomb split open from head to foot. The shrouded figure was as long and thin as it had been in life. He raised the wand again. The wrappings fell open. The face was translucent, pale, sunken, yet almost perfectly preserved. They had left his spectacles on the crooked nose. He felt amused derision. Dumbledore's hands were folded upon his chest, and there it lay, clutched beneath them, buried with him. Had the old fool imagined that marble or death would protect the wand? Had he thought that the Dark Lord would be scared to violate his tomb? The spider-like hands swooped and pulled the wand from Dumbledore's grasp, and, as he took it, a shower of sparks flew from its tip, sparkling over the corpse of its last owner, ready to serve a new master. At last. Chapter 25. Shell Cottage. Billenfleur's cottage stood alone on a cliff overlooking the sea, its walls embedded with shells and whitewashed. It was a lonely and beautiful place. Wherever Harry went inside the tiny cottage or its garden, he could hear the constant ebb and flow of the sea, like the breathing of some great slumbering creature. He spent much of the next few days making excuses to escape the crowded cottage, craving the cliff-top view of open sky and wide, empty sea and the feel of cold, salty wind on his face. The enormity of his decision not to race Voldemort to the wand still scared Harry. He could not remember ever before choosing not to act. He was full of doubts, doubts that Ron could not help voice him whenever they were together. "What if Dumbledore wanted us to work out the symbol in time to get the wand? What if working out what the symbol meant made you worthy to get the Hallows? Harry, if that really is the Elder Wand, how the hell are we supposed to finish off you-know-who?" Harry had no answers. There were moments when he wondered whether it had been outright madness not to try to prevent Voldemort breaking open the tomb. He could not even explain satisfactorily why he had decided against it. Every time he tried to reconstruct the internal arguments that had led to his decision, they sounded feebler to him. The odd thing was that Hermione's support made him feel just as confused as Ron's doubts. Now forced to accept that the Elder Wand was real, she maintained that it was an evil object, and that the way Voldemort had taken possession of it was repellent, not to be considered. "You could never have done that, Harry," she said again and again. "You couldn't have broken into Dumbledore's grave." But the idea of Dumbledore's corpse frightened Harry much less than the possibility that he might have misunderstood the living Dumbledore's intentions. He felt that he was still groping in the dark. He had chosen his path but kept looking back, wondering whether he had misread the signs, whether he should not have taken the other way. From time to time, anger at Dumbledore crashed over him again, powerful as the waves slamming themselves against the cliff beneath the cottage. Anger that Dumbledore had not explained before he died.
"But is he dead?"
said Ron, 3 days after they had arrived at the cottage. Harry had been staring out over the wall that separated the cottage garden from the cliff when Ron and Hermione had found him. He wished they had not, having no wish to join in with their argument.
"Yes, he is, Ron. Please, don't start that again. Look at the facts, Hermione,"
said Ron, speaking across Harry, who continued to gaze at the horizon.
"The Silver Doe, the sword, the eye Harry saw in the mirror. Harry admits he could have imagined the eye, don't you, Harry?"
"I could have," said Harry, without looking at her.
"But you don't think you did, do you?"
asked Ron. "No, I don't," said Harry.
"There you go,"
said Ron quickly, before Hermione could carry on.
"If it wasn't Dumbledore, explain how Dobby knew we were in the cellar, Hermione."
"I can't,"
But can you explain how Dumbledore sent him to us if he's lying in a tomb at Hogwarts?
I don't know. It could have been his ghost.
Dumbledore wouldn't come back as a ghost, said Harry. There was little about Dumbledore he was sure of now, but he knew that much. He would have gone on.
What do you mean,
gone on? Asked Ron. But before Harry could say any more, a voice behind them said,
Harry?
Fleur had come out of the cottage, her long silver hair flying in the breeze.
Harry, Griphook would like to speak to you. He is in the smallest bedroom. He says he does not want to be overheard.
Her dislike of the goblin sending her to deliver messages was clear. She looked irritable as she walked back around the house. Griphook was waiting for them, as Fleur had said, in the tiniest of the cottage's three bedrooms, in which Hermione and Luna slept by night. He had drawn the red cotton curtains against the bright, cloudy sky, which gave the room a fiery glow at odds with the rest of the airy, light cottage.
I have reached my decision, Harry Potter, said the goblin,
who was sitting cross-legged in a low chair, drumming its arms with his spindly fingers.
Though the goblins of Gringotts will consider it base treachery, I have decided to help you.
That's great, said Harry, relief surging through him. Griphook, thank you. We're really...
In return,
said the goblin firmly,
for payment.
Slightly taken aback, Harry hesitated. How much do you want? I've got gold.
Not gold, said Griphook. I have gold.
His black eyes glittered. There were no whites to his eyes.
I want the sword. The sword of Godric Gryffindor.
Harry's spirits plummeted. You can't have that, he said. I'm sorry.
Then,
said the goblin softly,
we have a problem.
We can give you something else, said Ron eagerly. I'll bet the Lestranges have got loads of stuff. You can take your pick once we get into the vault. He has said the wrong thing. Griphook flushed angrily.
I am not a thief, boy. I am not trying to procure treasures to which I have no right.
The sword's ours.
It is not, said the goblin.
We're Gryffindors, and it was Godric Gryffindor's.
And before it was Gryffindor's, whose was it?
Demanded the goblin, sitting up straight.
No one's, said Ron.
It was made for him, wasn't it?
No,
cried the goblin, bristling with anger as he pointed a long finger at Ron.
Wizarding arrogance again. That sword was Ragnook the First's, taken from him by Godric Gryffindor. It is a lost treasure, a masterpiece of goblin work. It belongs with the goblins. The sword is the price of my hire. Take it or leave it.
Griphook glared at them. Harry glanced at the other two, then said, We need to discuss this, Griphook, if that's all right. Could you give us a few minutes? The goblin nodded, looking sour. Downstairs in the empty sitting room, Harry walked to the fireplace, brow furrowed, trying to think what to do. Behind him, Ron said,
He's having a laugh. We can't let him have that sword.
It is true, Harry asked Hermione. Was the sword stolen by Gryffindor?
I don't know,
she said hopelessly. Wizarding history often skates over what the wizards have done to other magical races, but there's no account that I know of that says Gryffindor stole the sword.
It'll be one of those goblin stories, said Ron,
about how the wizards are always trying to get one over on them.
I suppose we should think ourselves lucky he hasn't asked for one of our wands.
Goblins have got good reason to dislike wizards, Ron, said Hermione. They've been treated brutally in the past.
Goblins aren't exactly fluffy little bunnies, though, are they?
Said Ron.
They've killed plenty of us. They've fought dirty, too.
But arguing with Griphook about whose race is most underhanded and violent isn't going to make him more likely to help us, is it? There was a pause while they tried to think of a way around the problem. Harry looked out of the window at Dobby's grave. Luna was arranging sea lavender in a jam jar beside the headstone.
Okay,
said Ron, and Harry turned back to face him.
How's this? We tell Griphook we need the sword until we get inside the vault, and then he can have it. There's a fake in there, isn't there? We switch them and give him the fake.
Ron, he'd know the difference better than we would, said Hermione.
He's the only one who realized there had been a swap.
Yeah,
but we can scarp her before he realizes.
He quailed beneath the look Hermione was giving him.
That,
she said quietly,
is despicable. Ask for his help, then double-cross him? And you wonder why goblins don't like wizards, Ron.
Ron's ears had turned red.
All right, it was the only thing I could think of. What's your solution, then?
We need to offer him something else, something just as valuable.
Brilliant! I'll go and get one of our other ancient goblin-made swords, and you can gift-wrap it.
Silence fell between them again. Harry was sure that the goblin would accept nothing but the sword, even if they had something as valuable to offer him. Yet the sword was their one indispensable weapon against the Horcruxes. He closed his eyes for a moment or two and listened to the rush of the sea. The idea that Gryffindor might have stolen the sword was unpleasant to him. He had always been proud to be a Gryffindor. Gryffindor had been the champion of Muggleborns, the wizard who had clashed with the pureblood-loving Slytherin.
Maybe he's lying,
Harry said, opening his eyes again. Griphook! Maybe Gryffindor didn't take the sword. How do we know the goblin version of history's right?
Does it make a difference?
Asked Hermione.
Changes how I feel about it, said Harry.
He took a deep breath.
We'll tell him he can have the sword after he's helped us get into that vault. But we'll be careful to avoid telling him exactly when he can have it.
A grin spread slowly across Ron's face. Hermione, however, looked alarmed.
Harry, we can't. He can have it,
Harry went on, after we've used it on all of the Horcruxes. I'll make sure he gets it then.
I'll keep my word.
But that could be years,
said Hermione.
I know that, but he needn't. I won't be lying.
Really? Harry met her eyes with a mixture of defiance and shame. He remembered the words that had been engraved over the gateway to Nurmengard. For the greater good. He pushed the idea away. What choice did they have?
I don't like it,
said Hermione.
Nor do I, much,
Harry admitted.
Well, I think it's genius, said Ron, standing up again. Let's go and tell him.
Back in the smallest bedroom, Harry made the offer, careful to phrase it so as not to give any definite time for the handover of the sword. Hermione frowned at the floor while he was speaking. He felt irritated at her, afraid that she might give the game away. However, Griphook had eyes for nobody but Harry.
I have your word, Harry Potter, that you will give me the sword of Gryffindor if I help you.
Yes, said Harry.
Then shake,
said the goblin, holding out his hand. Harry took it and shook. He wondered whether those black eyes saw any misgivings in his own. Then Griphook relinquished him, clapped his hands together and said,
So, we begin.
It was like planning to break into the ministry all over again. They settled to work in the smallest bedroom, which was kept, according to Griphook's preference, in semi-darkness.
I have visited the Lestrange's vault only once,
Griphook told them.
On the occasion, I was told to place inside it the false sword. It is one of the most ancient chambers. The oldest wizarding families store their treasures at the deepest level, where the vaults are largest and best protected.
They remained shut in the cupboard-like room for hours at a time. Slowly the days stretched into weeks. There was problem after problem to overcome, not least of which was that their store of polyjuice potion was greatly depleted.
There's really only enough left for one of us,
said Hermione, tilting the thick mud-like potion against the lamplight. That'll be enough, said Harry, who was examining Griphook's hand-drawn map of the deepest passageways. The other inhabitants of Shell Cottage could hardly fail to notice that something was going on, now that Harry, Ron, and Hermione only emerged for mealtimes. Nobody asked questions, although Harry often felt Bill's eyes on the three of them at the table, thoughtful, concerned. The longer they spent together, the more Harry realized that he did not much like the goblin. Griphook was unexpectedly bloodthirsty, laughed at the idea of pain in lesser creatures, and seemed to relish the possibility that they might have to hurt other wizards to reach the Lestrange's vault. Harry could tell that his distaste was shared by the other two, but they did not discuss it. They needed Griphook. The goblin ate only grudgingly with the rest of them. Even after his legs had mended, he continued to request trays of food in his room, like the still-frail Ollivander, until Bill, following an angry outburst from Fleur, went upstairs to tell him that the arrangement could not continue. Thereafter, Griphook joined them at the overcrowded table, although he refused to eat the same food, insisting instead on lumps of raw meat, roots, and various fungi. Harry felt responsible. It was, after all, he who had insisted that the goblin remain at Shell Cottage, so that he could question him. His fault that the whole Weasley family had been driven into hiding, that Bill, Fred, George, and Mr. Weasley could no longer work. "I'm sorry," he told Fleur one blustery April evening as he helped her prepare dinner. "I never meant you to have to deal with all of this." She had just set some knives to work, chopping up steaks for Griphook and Bill, who had preferred his meat bloody ever since he had been attacked by Greyback. While the knives sliced away behind her, her somewhat irritable expression softened.
"Harry, you saved my sister's life. I do not forget."
This was not, strictly speaking, true, but Harry decided against reminding her that Gabrielle had never been in real danger.
"Anyway,"
Fleur went on, pointing her wand at a pot of sauce on the stove, which began to bubble at once.
"Mr. Ollivander leaves for Muriel's this evening. That will make things easier. The goblin," she scowled a little at the mention of him, "can move downstairs, and you, Ron and Dean, can take that room."
"We don't mind sleeping in the living room," said Harry, who knew that Griphook would think poorly of having to sleep on the sofa. Keeping Griphook happy was essential to their plans.
"Don't worry about us."
And when she tried to protest, he went on, "We'll be off your hands soon, too, Ron, Hermione, and I. We won't need to be here much longer."
"But what do you mean?"
she said, frowning at him, her wand pointing at the casserole dish now suspended in midair.
"Of course you must not leave. You are safe here."
She looked rather like Mrs. Weasley as she said it, and he was glad that the back door opened at that moment. Luna and Dean entered, their hair damp from the rain outside, and their arms full of driftwood.
"And tiny little ears," Luna was saying. "A bit like a hippo's," Daddy says, "only purple and hairy. And if you want to call them, you have to hum. They prefer a waltz. Nothing too fast."
Looking uncomfortable, Dean shrugged at Harry as he passed, following Luna into the combined dining and sitting room, where Ron and Hermione were laying the dinner table. Seizing the chance to escape Fleur's questions, Harry grabbed two jugs of pumpkin juice and followed them.
"And if you ever come to our house, I'll be able to show you the horn. Daddy wrote to me about it, but I haven't seen it yet, because the Death Eaters took me from the Hogwarts Express, and I never got home for Christmas,"
Luna was saying, as she and Dean relayed the fire.
"Luna, we told you," Hermione called over to her. "That horn exploded. It came from an irrumpant, not a crumple horn snorkack." "No, it was definitely a snorkack horn," said Luna serenely. "Daddy told me. It will probably have reformed by now. They mend themselves, you know."
Hermione shook her head and continued laying down forks as Bill appeared, leading Mr. Ollivander down the stairs. The wand maker still looked exceptionally frail, and he clung to Bill's arm as the latter supported him, carrying a large suitcase.
"I'm going to miss you, Mr. Ollivander," said Luna, approaching the old man. "And I you, my dear,"
said Ollivander, patting her on the shoulder.
"You were an inexpressible comfort to me in that terrible place." "So, au revoir, Mr. Ollivander,"
said Fleur, kissing him on both cheeks.
"And I wonder whether you could oblige me by delivering a package to Bill's Auntie Muriel. I never returned her tiara." "It will be an honor,"
said Ollivander with a little bow.
"The very least I can do in return for your generous hospitality."
Fleur drew out a worn velvet case, which she opened to show the wandmaker. The tiara sat glittering and twinkling in the light from the low-hanging lamp.
"Moonstones and diamonds," said Griphook,
who had sidled into the room without Harry noticing.
"Made by goblins, I think."
"And paid for by wizards," said Bill quietly, and the goblin shot him a look that was both furtive and challenging. A strong wind gusted against the cottage windows as Bill and Ollivander set off into the night. The rest of them squeezed in around the table, elbow to elbow, and with barely enough room to move, they started to eat. The fire crackled and popped in the grate beside them. Fleur, Harry noticed, was merely playing with her food. She glanced at the window every few minutes. However, Bill returned before they had finished their first course, his long hair tangled by the wind.
"Everything's fine," he told Fleur. "Ollivander's settled in. Mum and Dad say hello. Ginny sends you all her love. Fred and George are driving Muriel up the wall. They're still operating an owl order business out of her back room. It cheered her up to have her tiara back, though. She said she thought we'd stolen it."
"Ah, she is charmant, your aunt," said Fleur crossly, waving her wand and causing the dirty plates to rise and form a stack in midair.
She caught them and marched out of the room.
"Daddy's made a tiara," piped up Luna. "Well, more of a crown, really."
Ron caught Harry's eye and grinned. Harry knew that he was remembering the ludicrous headdress they had seen on their visit to Xenophilius.
"Yes, he's trying to recreate the lost diadem of Ravenclaw. He thinks he's identified most of the main elements now. Adding the billywig wings really made a difference."
There was a bang on the front door. Everyone's head turned toward it. Fleur came running out of the kitchen, looking frightened. Bill jumped to his feet, his wand pointing at the door. Harry, Ron, and Hermione did the same. Silently, Griphook slipped beneath the table, out of sight.
"Who is it?"
Bill called.
"It is I, Remus John Lupin," called a voice over the howling wind.
Harry experienced a thrill of fear. What had happened?
"I am a werewolf, married to Nymphadora Tonks. And you, the secret keeper of Shell Cottage, told me the address and bade me come in an emergency."
"Lupin,"
muttered Bill, and he ran to the door and wrenched it open. Lupin fell over the threshold. He was white-faced, wrapped in a traveling cloak, his graying hair windswept. He straightened up, looked around the room, making sure of who was there, then cried aloud,
"It's a boy! We've named him Ted, after Dora's father."
Hermione shrieked.
"What? Tonks? Tonks has had the baby?"
"Yes, yes, she's had the baby,"
shouted Lupin. All around the table came cries of delight, sighs of relief. Hermione and Fleur both squealed,
"Congratulations!"
And Ron said,
"Blimey, a baby!"
As if he had never heard of such a thing before.
"Yes, yes, a boy,"
said Lupin again, who seemed dazed by his own happiness. He strode around the table and hugged Harry. The scene in the basement of Grimald Place might never have happened.
"You'll be godfather?"
he said as he released Harry.
"Me?"
stammered Harry.
"You, yes, of course.
Dora quite agrees. No one better."
Blimey.
Harry felt overwhelmed, astonished, delighted. Now Bill was hurrying to fetch wine, and Fleur was persuading Lupin to join them for a drink.
"I can't stay long. I must get back," said Lupin, beaming around at them all.
He looked years younger than Harry had ever seen him.
"Thank you. Thank you, Bill."
Bill had soon filled all of their goblets. They stood and raised them high in a toast.
"To Teddy Remus Lupin," said Lupin. "A great wizard in the making."
"Who does he look like?"
Fleur inquired.
"I think he looks like Dora, but she thinks he is like me. Not much hair.
It looked black when he was born, but I swear it's turned ginger in the hour since. Probably be blonde by the time I get back. Andromeda said Tonks's hair started changing colour the day that she was born."
He drained his goblet.
"Oh, go on then, just one more,"
he added, beaming, as Bill made to fill it again. The wind buffeted the little cottage, and the fire leapt and crackled, and Bill was soon opening another bottle of wine. Lupin's news seemed to have taken them out of themselves, removed them for a while from their state of siege. Tidings of new life were exhilarating. Only the goblin seemed untouched by the suddenly festive atmosphere, and after a while he slunk back to the bedroom he now occupied alone. Harry thought he was the only one who had noticed this, until he saw Bill's eyes following the goblin up the stairs. No, no, I really must get back, said Lupin at last, declining yet another goblet of wine. He got to his feet and pulled his travelling cloak back around himself. Goodbye, goodbye. I'll try and bring some pictures in a few days' time. They'll all be so glad to know that I've seen you. He fastened his cloak and made his farewells, hugging the women and grasping hands with the men. Then, still beaming, returned into the wild night. Godfather Harry, said Bill as they walked into the kitchen together, helping clear the table. A real honor. Congratulations. As Harry set down the empty goblets he was carrying, Bill pulled the door behind him closed, shutting out the still voluble voices of the others, who were continuing to celebrate even in Lupin's absence.
I wanted a private word, actually, Harry. It hasn't been easy to get an opportunity with the cottage this full of people.
Bill hesitated.
Harry, you're planning something with Griphook.
It was a statement, not a question, and Harry did not bother to deny it. He merely looked at Bill, waiting.
I know goblins, said Bill. I've worked for Gringotts ever since I left Hogwarts. As far as there can be friendship between wizards and goblins, I have goblin friends, or at least goblins I know well and like.
Again, Bill hesitated.
Harry, what do you want from Griphook, and what have you promised him in return?
I can't tell you that, said Harry. Sorry, Bill. The kitchen door opened behind them. Fleur was trying to bring through more empty goblets.
Wait, Bill told her. Just a moment.
She backed out, and he closed the door again.
Then I have to say this, Bill went on. If you have struck any kind of bargain with Griphook, and most particularly if that bargain involves treasure, you must be exceptionally careful. Goblin notions of ownership, payment and repayment are not the same as human ones.
Harry felt a slight squirm of discomfort, as though a small snake had stirred inside him.
What do you mean? He asked. We are talking about a different breed of being, said Bill. Dealings between wizards and goblins have been fraught for centuries, but you'll know all that from history of magic. There has been fault on both sides. I would never claim that wizards have been innocent. However, there is a belief among some goblins, and those at Gringotts are perhaps most prone to it, that wizards cannot be trusted in matters of gold and treasure, that they have no respect for goblin ownership.
I respect, Harry began, but Bill shook his head.
You don't understand, Harry. Nobody could understand unless they have lived with goblins. To a goblin, the rightful and true master of any object is the maker, not the purchaser. All goblin-made objects are, in goblin eyes, rightfully theirs. But if it was bought, then they would consider it rented by the one who had paid the money. They have, however, great difficulty with the idea of goblin-made objects passing from wizard to wizard. You saw Griphook's face when the tiara passed under his eyes. He disapproves. I believe he thinks, as do the fiercest of his kind, that it ought to have been returned to the goblins once the original purchaser died. They consider our habit of keeping goblin-made objects, passing them from wizard to wizard without further payment, little more than theft.
Harry had an ominous feeling now. He wondered whether Bill guessed more than he was letting on.
All I am saying, said Bill, setting his hand on the door back into the sitting room, is to be very careful what you promise goblins, Harry. It would be less dangerous to break into Gringotts than to renege on a promise to a goblin.
Right, said Harry, as Bill opened the door.
Yeah, thanks. I'll bear that in mind.
As he followed Bill back to the others, a wry thought came to him, born no doubt of the wine he had drunk. He seemed set on course to become just as reckless a godfather to Teddy Lupin as Sirius Black had been to him. Chapter 26 Gringotts. Their plans were made, their preparations complete. In the smallest bedroom, a single long, coarse black hair, plucked from the sweater Hermione had been wearing at Malfoy Manor, lay curled in a small glass phial on the mantelpiece.
And you'll be using her actual wand, said Harry, nodding toward the walnut wand. So I reckon you'll be pretty convincing.
Hermione looked frightened that the wand might sting or bite her as she picked it up.
I hate this thing, she said in a low voice. I really hate it. It feels all wrong. It doesn't work properly for me. It's like a bit of her.
Harry could not help but remember how Hermione had dismissed his loathing of the Blackthorn wand, insisting that he was imagining things when it did not work as well as his own, telling him to simply practice. He chose not to repeat her own advice back to her, however. The eve of their attempted assault on Gringotts felt like the wrong moment to antagonize her.
It'll probably help you get in character, though, said Ron. Think what that wand's done. But that's my point, said Hermione. This is the wand that tortured Neville's mum and dad, and who knows how many other people. This is the wand that killed Sirius.
Harry had not thought of that. He looked down at the wand and was visited by a brutal urge to snap it, to slice it in half with Gryffindor's sword, which was propped against the wall beside him.
I miss my wand, Hermione said miserably. I wish Mr. Ollivander could have made me another one, too.
Mr. Ollivander had sent Luna a new wand that morning. She was out on the back lawn at that moment, testing its capabilities in the late afternoon sun. Dean, who had lost his wand to the Snatchers, was watching rather gloomily. Harry looked down at the Hawthorn wand that had once belonged to Draco Malfoy. He had been surprised, but pleased, to discover that it worked for him, at least as well as Hermione's had done. Remembering what Ollivander had told him of the secret workings of wands, Harry thought he knew what Hermione's problem was. She had not won the Walnut Wand's allegiance by taking it personally from Bellatrix. The door of the bedroom opened and Griphook entered. Harry reached instinctively for the hilt of the sword and drew it close to him, but regretted his action at once. He could tell that the goblin had noticed. Seeking to gloss over the sticky moment, he said, We've just been checking the last-minute stuff, Griphook. We've told Bill and Fleur we're leaving tomorrow, and we've told them not to get up to see us off. They had been firm on this point, because Hermione would need to transform into Bellatrix before they left, and the less that Bill and Fleur knew or suspected about what they were about to do, the better. They had also explained that they would not be returning. As they had lost Perkins's old tent on the night that the Snatchers caught them, Bill had lent them another one. It was now packed inside the beaded bag, which, Harry was impressed to learn, Hermione had protected from the Snatchers by the simple expedient of stuffing it down her sock. Though he would miss Bill, Fleur, Luna, and Dean, not to mention the home comforts they had enjoyed over the last few weeks, Harry was looking forward to escaping the confinement of Shell Cottage. He was tired of trying to make sure that they were not overheard, tired of being shut in the tiny, dark bedroom. Most of all, he longed to be rid of Griphook. However, precisely how and when they were to part from the goblin without handing over Gryffindor's sword remained a question to which Harry had no answer. It had been impossible to decide how they were going to do it, because the goblin rarely left Harry, Ron, and Hermione alone together for more than 5 minutes at a time.
He could give my mother lessons, growled Ron,
as the goblin's long fingers kept appearing around the edges of doors. With Bill's warning in mind, Harry could not help suspecting that Griphook was on the watch for possible skullduggery. Hermione disapproved so heartily of the planned double-cross that Harry had given up attempting to pick her brains on how best to do it. Ron, on the rare occasions that they had been able to snatch a few Griphook-free moments, had come up with nothing better than,
We'll just have to wing it, mate.
Harry slept badly that night. Lying awake in the early hours, he thought back to the way he had felt the night before they had infiltrated the Ministry of Magic, and remembered a determination, almost an excitement. Now he was experiencing jolts of anxiety, nagging doubts. He could not shake off the fear that it was all going to go wrong. He kept telling himself that their plan was good, that Griphook knew what they were facing, that they were well prepared for all the difficulties they were likely to encounter. Yet still he felt uneasy. Once or twice he heard Ron stir and was sure that he too was awake, but they were sharing the sitting room with Dean, so Harry did not speak. It was a relief when 6 o'clock arrived, and they could slip out of their sleeping bags, dress in the semi-darkness, then creep out into the garden, where they were to meet Hermione and Griphook. The dawn was chilly, but there was little wind now that it was May. Harry looked up at the stars still glimmering palely in the dark sky, and listened to the sea washing backward and forward against the cliff. He was going to miss the sound. Small green shoots were forcing their way up through the red earth of Dobby's grave now. In a year's time, the mound would be covered in flowers. The white stone that bore the elf's name had already acquired a weathered look. He realized now that they could hardly have laid Dobby to rest in a more beautiful place. But Harry ached with sadness to think of leaving him behind. Looking down on the grave, he wondered yet again how the elf had known where to come to rescue them. His fingers moved absent-mindedly to the little pouch still strung around his neck, through which he could feel the jagged mirror fragment in which he had been sure he had seen Dumbledore's eye. Then the sound of a door opening made him look around. Bellatrix Lestrange was striding across the lawn toward them, accompanied by Griphook. As she walked, she was tucking the small beaded bag into the inside pocket of another set of the old robes they had taken from Grimald Place. Though Harry knew perfectly well that it was really Hermione, he could not suppress a shiver of loathing. She was taller than he was, her long black hair rippling down her back, her heavily lidded eyes disdainful as they rested upon him. But then she spoke, and he heard Hermione through Bellatrix's low voice.
"She tasted disgusting, worse than Gurdy Roots. Okay, Ron, come here so I can do you." "Right, but remember, I don't like the beard too long." "Oh, for heaven's sake, this isn't about looking handsome." "It's not that. It gets in the way. But I liked my nose a bit shorter. Try and do it the way you did last time."
Hermione sighed and set to work, muttering under her breath as she transformed various aspects of Ron's appearance. He was to be given a completely fake identity, and they were trusting to the malevolent aura cast by Bellatrix to protect him. Meanwhile, Harry and Griphook were to be concealed under the invisibility cloak.
"There," said Hermione. "How does he look, Harry?"
It was just possible to discern Ron under his disguise, but only, Harry thought, because he knew him so well. Ron's hair was now long and wavy. He had a thick brown beard and moustache, no freckles, a short, broad nose, and heavy eyebrows.
"Well, he's not my type, but he'll do," said Harry. "Shall we go, then?"
All three of them glanced back at Shell Cottage, lying dark and silent under the fading stars, then turned and began to walk toward the point, just beyond the boundary wall, where the Fidelius charm stopped working, and they would be able to disapparate. Once past the gate, Griphook spoke.
"I should climb up now, Harry Potter, I think."
Harry bent down, and the goblin clambered onto his back, his hands linked in front of Harry's throat. He was not heavy, but Harry disliked the feeling of the goblin and the surprising strength with which he clung on. Hermione pulled the invisibility cloak out of the beaded bag and threw it over them both.
"Perfect,"
she said, bending down to check Harry's feet.
"I can't see a thing. Let's go."
Harry turned on the spot, with Griphook on his shoulders, concentrating with all his might on the leaky cauldron, the inn that was the entrance to Diagon Alley. The goblin clung even tighter as they moved into the compressing darkness, and seconds later Harry's feet found pavement, and he opened his eyes on Charing Cross Road. Muggles bustled past wearing the hangdog expressions of early morning, quite unconscious of the little inn's existence. The bar of the leaky cauldron was nearly deserted. Tom, the stooped and toothless landlord, was polishing glasses behind the bar counter. A couple of warlocks having a muttered conversation in the far corner glanced at Hermione and drew back into the shadows.
"Madame Lestrange,"
murmured Tom, and as Hermione passed, he inclined his head subserviently.
"Good morning,"
said Hermione, and as Harry crept past, still carrying Griphook piggyback under the cloak, he saw Tom look surprised.
"Too polite,"
Harry whispered in Hermione's ear as they passed out of the inn into the tiny backyard.
"You need to treat people like they're scum."
"Okay, okay."
Hermione drew out Bellatrix's wand and tapped a brick in the nondescript wall in front of them. At once the bricks began to whirl and spin. A hole appeared in the middle of them, which grew wider and wider, finally forming an archway onto the narrow cobbled street that was Diagon Alley. It was quiet, barely time for the shops to open, and there were hardly any shoppers abroad. The crooked cobbled street was much altered now from the bustling place Harry had visited before his first term at Hogwarts so many years before. More shops than ever were boarded up, though several new establishments dedicated to the dark arts had been created since his last visit. Harry's own face glared down at him from posters plastered over many windows, always captioned with the words, "Undesirable Number One." A number of ragged people sat huddled in doorways. He heard them moaning to the few passers-by, pleading for gold, insisting that they were really wizards. One man had a bloody bandage over his eye. As they set off along the street, the beggars glimpsed Hermione. They seemed to melt away before her, drawing hoods over their faces and fleeing as fast as they could. Hermione looked after them curiously, until the man with the bloodied bandage came staggering right across her path.
"My children!"
he bellowed, pointing at her. His voice was cracked, high-pitched. He sounded distraught.
"Where are my children? What has he done with them? You know!
I really..." stammered Hermione.
The man lunged at her, reaching for her throat. Then, with a bang and a burst of red light, he was thrown backward onto the ground, unconscious. Ron stood there, his wand still outstretched and a look of shock visible behind his beard. Faces appeared at the windows on either side of the street, while a little knot of prosperous-looking passers-by gathered their robes about them and broke into gentle trots, keen to vacate the scene. Their entrance into Diagon Alley could hardly have been more conspicuous. For a moment, Harry wondered whether it might not be better to leave now and try to think of a different plan. Before they could move or consult one another, however, they heard a cry from behind them.
"Why, Madame Lestrange!"
Harry whirled around, and Griphook tightened his hold around Harry's neck. A tall, thin wizard with a crown of bushy grey hair and a long, sharp nose was striding toward them.
"It's Travers,"
hissed the goblin into Harry's ear. But at that moment, Harry could not think who Travers was. Hermione had drawn herself up to her fullest height and said with as much contempt as she could muster,
"And what do you want?"
Travers stopped in his tracks, clearly affronted.
"He's another Death Eater,"
breathed Griphook, and Harry sidled sideways to repeat the information into Hermione's ear.
"I merely sought to greet you," said Travers coolly. "But if my presence is not welcome..."
Harry recognized his voice now. Travers was one of the Death Eaters who had been summoned to Xenophilius's house.
"No, no, not at all, Travers,"
said Hermione quickly, trying to cover up her mistake.
"How are you?" "Well, I confess I am surprised to see you out and about, Bellatrix."
"Really? Why?"
asked Hermione.
"Well," Travers coughed, "I heard that the inhabitants of Malfoy Manor were confined to the house after the, escape."
Harry willed Hermione to keep her head. If this was true and Bellatrix was not supposed to be out in public...
"The Dark Lord forgives those who have served him most faithfully in the past,"
said Hermione in a magnificent imitation of Bellatrix's most contemptuous manner.
"Perhaps your credit is not as good with him as mine is, Travers."
Though the Death Eater looked offended, he also seemed less suspicious. He glanced down at the man Ron had just stunned.
"How did it offend you?"
"It does not matter.
It will not do so again," said Hermione coolly. "Some of these wandlers can be troublesome," said Travers. "While they do nothing but beg, I have no objection. But one of them actually asked me to plead her case at the Ministry last week."
"I'm a witch, sir! I'm a witch! Let me prove it to you,"
he said in a squeaky impersonation.
"As if I was going to give her my wand. But whose wand," said Travers curiously, "are you using at the moment, Bellatrix? I heard that your own was..."
"I have my wand here,"
said Hermione coldly, holding up Bellatrix's wand.
"I don't know what rumors you have been listening to, Travers, but you seem sadly misinformed."
Travers seemed a little taken aback at that, and he turned instead to Ron.
Who is your friend? I do not recognize him.
This is Dragomir Despard, said Hermione.